Welcome to the best of the RSN Breakfast Club. Here's a little bit of what we did. Take a listen.
I want to talk to Rob Harris from the Associated Press on the news overnight that Michel Platini has been arrested in France, or so we think. Whitey? Rob's with us on the Breakfast Club this morning. G'day, Rob.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. This is a significant development overnight with Michel Platini being... has he been arrested, or is he just... providing testimony, as one of his counsellors have claimed?
Well, I mean, he is in custody. He is there on the outskirts of Paris, being under questioning, as we understand it, all day about this investigation, not only into World Cup bidding, but also how France won the right to host the European Championship in 2016.
Right, so it's not just the Qatar situation, there's more to it.
Yeah, we discovered that actually from the statement from Michel Platini's side, the fact that there is happy questions about the Euro 2026 decision as well. But obviously the far bigger one really is that 2022 World Cup vote, obviously something that still grates heavily in Australia with that one vote gained in the first round before Qatar went on to beat the US in the final round.
So what are the ramifications for Michel himself, but also I imagine if you're involved in some sort of fraudulent activities or almost espionage to a degree, what surely you're not doing that by yourself?
Well, obviously at this stage he is just in question and there's been no charge at this point. There are many and several other French investigations, sports bidding, that haven't reached court even yet, the Olympics and the IAAF World Championship as well. So there's no sort of expectation time frame on this. So that, you know, in terms of what happens to Michel Platini himself, he'll be hoping that he is released without facing any further action. That basically his account of denying wrongdoing, but we'll wait for news from the French authorities. And then the wider focus is on Qatar, and, you know, the wide expectation is that they're not under any threat. They're facing accusations from all sides over just how they won that vote in December 2010, but have always denied wrongdoing and persisting in organising the tournament, even though a FIFA report did find some issues around the conduct, but found that it didn't warrant in any way removing them off the tournament.
So what is it that we're exactly looking at with this bidding process that is being brought into question? Do we have kind of the detail that they're basing this on at the moment?
Well, it is the specialist unit that looks into financial crimes and corruption. And what a lot of people focus on is a key meeting just a few weeks before the vote, back in November 2010, when then-French President Sarkozy had met with not only Michel Platini, but also Qatari officials, the Crown Prince, who went on to become the Emir. And Platini insisted that his vote was not influenced by what happened at that meeting or by Sarkozy. He said, Sarkozy never asked me to vote for Qatar, but I knew what would be good. There were comments from 4 years ago. Seth Blatter, who was FIFA president at the time, offered a different account. He believed he had a gentleman's agreement with Platini that they would vote for the US, and the fact that Platini went back on that and said he had to, you know, vote for Qatar.
Rob, just with all that's gone on, and we've known that, let's be honest, it's been a bit dodgy for a while now with Qatar getting the World Cup. Is it still a situation where it will definitely be held there, or does this open the debate again as to whether they should actually hold it?
Yeah, I mean, for many people, they were thinking it was a bad decision anyway, on multiple fronts, too hot. There were warnings that were ignored by the FIFA Executive Committee at the time about the heat. It then obviously had to be forced to be moved from the June, July to the November, December slot. Many questions over the human rights and working conditions that have actually been there to build the stadium. Qatar will point to some progress that it has made in terms of improving those conditions. And then at the heart of it are questions about the bidding conduct and how much was the wealth of Qatar used to actually win that vote. And Qatar would point to investigations where they... have been found not to have influenced the vote through those means, but, you know, we've seen in the Brooklyn courtroom a year and a half or so ago, new accusations then were levelled there about, you know, were finance inducements being offered, accusations that Qatar have actually denied, particularly from those. So all these questions do persist, while Qatar broadly insist that it won the vote fairly. But even up until kickoff in November 2022, these questions are sure to linger about the way it was won.
Jim Crowley makes a move. He's given up on Hootson, giving him a lead, and now he's tacked across to join the main group. They've only got a furlong and a half to go. Soldiers call now leads. Blue Point on the far side, being followed then by Mabs Cross. Now Batash is unleashed towards the near side by Jim Crowley. Inside the final furlong they go. Batash on the near side. On the far side is Blue Point. A repeat of last year. Blue Point once again has got the measure of Batash. And Blue Point becomes only the 12th horse in history to win the King's Fan Stakes twice in his career. It was Blue Point.
Blue Point for Godolphin again, just getting the job done in the King's Stand, 12th horse in history, as you heard. To win it twice to kick off Royal Ascot, the King Stand Stakes. Jason Richardson, my understanding is, has been selfing himself silly because they love him over there, the English people. He joins us on the Breakfast Club. Hello, Richo.
Oh, massive news over here.
I've heard that.
Seriously, massive news.
I have heard that. Day one of the Royal Ascot Carnival kicked off last night. What did she wear? What colour did she wear, the Queen?
Well, once again, Half, I made the fundamental error. The 2-1 into 5-4 on favourite was the blue.
I would have gone the blue.
Pink. Pink was second favourite at $3, three to one. Purple was at 5-1. Lemon at 7-1. And I went all the way down to 1,000-1, the bandana. And the favourite got up, so I did my money cold.
Goodness,
I've got to learn. She doesn't do a bandana, does she?
Do they have to check betting records? If there's a plunge on the blue, someone's got the mail what the Queen's doing.
Whitey, you make a really good point, because every time there's a plunge on something and then suddenly she emerges, and there she is in the colour that's been packed into favouritism, I always go, hang on, what's going on here? You know what? I'm just going to go time and time again with the bandana, and one of these days I'm going to get it right.
She's going to surprise you one day and rock up with the bandana. That would be fantastic. Now, from an Australian perspective, in the King's Stand last night, we had Hootson as our representative. Didn't it all go to plan, Richo, for Hootson?
Yeah, I spoke to Kieran McAvoy after the race, and Hootson slipped out of the gates, put a couple of faulty strides in, and then he let her rip and she went forward. But considering her little mishap at the start, I mean, to be absolutely brutal and fair, she's probably not one of our absolute A++ sprinters. She's been a fantastic sprinter, and when she won the Magic Millions 2-year-old, she was superb. She was unlucky in a Manicato, but the reality is she hadn't won a Group 1. We've had so many great sprinters in the last couple of years retire as studs, so she had an opportunity here, but they went to Royal Ascot. It's been a great plan that I think, you know, we'll hear from Toby when he chats to Nugget Mickey Blue Eyes whether or not she stays here and serves by a Northern Hemisphere stallion. That may be the plan all along for Aquas Farm, but she wasn't up to it today. And then we had Blue Point versus Batash, exactly what we had this time last year, and Blue Point got over the top of him again. So you got a scenario with Sheikh Hamdan with Batash and Sheikh Mohammed with Blue Point. So Sherelle, they're brothers. So the two brothers are just going toe-to-toe with both of their horses there. So a win to Blue Point for Charlie Appleby and James Doyle. And maybe Blue Point might be the sort of horse that comes to Australia and has a crack at some of our sprinting millions that are up for grabs.
Very nice, Richo. And I've just been having a bit of a look at the weather too. A lot of umbrellas around. Mm. How is that affecting the conditions on the track and, of course, off the track with the fashions, which is probably more up my alley?
Yeah, well, the fashions have been... the raincoat was the number one fashion item throughout the day today, and the umbrella.
Yes.
But from a racing point of view, and this is going to be the big story leading into day two, will be Sea of Class, the Oaks winning filly, who was runner-up in the Prix de l'Arc de Triomphe behind the mighty Enable, was to be running in the Prince of Wales' Stakes, the richest race that they have at the Royal Meeting, £750,000. So that's about 1.5 million Aussie pesos. Our dollar's struggling a touch over here, but don't touch on that. But so she could be coming out due to the fact that there's so much rain that they believe it might be too shifty of a surface for her. And then also we start to think about the Ascot Gold Cup on Thursday, and Stradivarius, the superstar stayer, who's still in line for another of these million-pound bonuses to win all the staying races here. well, John Gosden, when we interviewed him, which I'm sure that interview is being replayed on RSN, saying that he really likes it nice and firm for his acceleration, his turn of foot, as the phrase that John used. The rain is going to continue again tomorrow, so we may have some big high-profile withdrawals. If Sea of Class comes out on the Prince of Wales Estates and maybe even Stradivarius out of the Ascot Gold Cup, that'd be a huge shock and a huge blow to everyone at the Royal meeting.
The umpire was telling me to stay on the mark and I didn't want to borrow that. I'll give you the hot tip.
One of the harder challenges of your football career is just being able to get yourself ready to play and beat your best week in, week out.
I don't really see it as a big deal, really. It's rumour and innuendo and I've got nothing to do with it.
I think where we are is an accurate reflection of how we're performing.
I love the communication that the umpires have with the players. You know, when Razor gives someone a pat on the back, usually it's an experimental medalist just so he gets a bit of air time, something like that.
Your ticket into the heart of football. Welcome to the Breakfast Club's Inner Sanctum.
Nice to have him with us always. I'm sure he'd probably prefer to be somewhere else this morning, I must admit, though, after the news yesterday from the Magpies. Good morning, Taylor.
Good morning, Huff.
Nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
How's your last couple of days been?
Yeah, good. Good. It's obviously a bit happening in the world of the AFL at the moment. So.
Correct.
Plenty to cover this morning.
Plenty to cover. Firstly, before we get into the front page items today from your club, how are you, body-wise?
Yeah, getting there. Still not playing this week, and unlikely for the week after, but still holding out hope. It's just not progressing as well as we would like it to be. Still a little bit sore down there, so yeah, that's basically where I'm at the moment.
So throughout the bye period, were you intensive rehabilitating, or what were you
doing?
Yeah,
I stayed around Melbourne and I was able to get three sessions in with our rehab physio, Ben Shippard, and Matty Boyd, and got touched up a couple of times by Boydie, who's still fitter than most of our list, so that was good. So I got some really good training in over the bye and was able to make up some ground. Hopefully I can put my hand up for selection in a couple of weeks.
What now? I had heard a little bit of a whisper that on the track yesterday you spent a fair bit of time having a chat to Nathan Buckley at one point. What happens in that situation when Bucks has a chat to you? Because obviously you're frustrated, you want to be playing and all that sort of thing. What's the role of Nathan in supporting you through this frustrating period in your season?
Well, the emotion that I was feeling on Monday wasn't really frustration. It was more, I was upset. Sort of got some news that I sort of walked into the club on Monday with a bit of an optimistic approach, thinking that I might be a chance to put my hand up for this week or show some signs of improvement from Friday. And unfortunately, it was still a little bit sore. So my initial response was frustration. But then once I ran out of the track with the boys, I sort of became a little bit upset. Felt like I was missing out again and sort of became overwhelmed, and Bucks read the play pretty well and saw that I wasn't my usual jovial self, and just asked me how I was and sort of broke down with him, and we had just a good chat out in the track for 45 minutes about his experiences, and he gave me some advice and it was good. I just sort of opened up to him, and probably not the right place to do it when there's cameras and people around, but it was the right time for him and I to have a good chat, and I was able to get some quality out of my session after that and felt good about it.
So obviously Nathan had those hamstring issues which really plagued the back end of his career. What are the sort of things that he was talking to you about to help you? I mean, that's pretty dramatic that you break down on the training track.
Yeah, it's probably
not physically.
A little bit unlike me to do something like that, but we basically just spoke about how we can make such a negative situation that I'm currently in into a positive, and turn my season, which I think I'm dramatising, that's been almost washed away, into something that can be something really special. So sort of all doom and gloom, and that was basically his message, that I'm still valued around the group and can have a huge impact even when I'm not playing. So I think that's half the battle with players that are in rehab. You sort of feel a little bit undervalued because you can't do what you want to do and do what you know you can do out in the field. So for him to recognise that, speaks volumes of the sort of coach he is.
Is it an element of panic that you're seeing a team that you've been part of now for quite some time? You're in the top two. There's every chance you're going to head back towards at least September, that you're not going to be part of it. Is that part of your emotion, or is it more you can't be the leader you want to be? What's sort of evoking this emotion?
Well, logically, I know that I'm going to get back. I know for a fact I'm going to play footy this year again. Just I want to be playing right now. So I guess I'm impatient with, you know, in the fact that I'm missing out every week. Every week that goes by, I don't get to play. The emotion probably started at frustration, has now led to a little bit more of just sadness because I'm really miss playing. I miss doing what I love doing, and that's basically where it's at. When I think about it and really delve into it, I know that I'm going to be fine towards the end of the year, and you know the season isn't a complete waste for me. I think the frustrating thing for me is, you know, I barely missed a session in the preseason, then I come out and hurt my finger, and then play four games, and then re-injure myself. So I'll get over it and work through it. It's just a little hurdle, and once I get to the other side of it, it'll feel quite insignificant, I think.
Taylor, we can hear the emotion in your voice, and we can see it on your face. It's a tough time, obviously, being in rehab, and as you've expressed, there's been the finger and then this re-injury. What sort of things does the club put around you to kind of help you through that from a mental point of view?
Oh, they've been really good with just overall my training program. It's sort of been run by myself, driven by myself, and sort of helped by our rehab physio and our head of strength and conditioning, Kevy. So the support that I've been given a lot of autonomy to take time when I needed it. The easy bit for me is training. I get to the club and I look forward to training. It's all the stuff that goes in between the, you know, your days off, your half days, where I feel like I'm sort of just floating around and not getting better. So the club have been awesome. If needed, there's plenty of support that you can seek outside. I've got a full time psychiatrist that obviously has a strong focus on your mental performance in games, but also just your general health and well-being. So, there's no shortage of support for me at the footy club. And, you know, I mentioned all those guys, and you think about the coaching staff, like my line coaches, and then Bucks. Nick Maxwell's there, you can lean on. And then all the players that have been great support for all the boys that go through any sort of injury.
Does an element of the frustration come because of the uncertainty that when you originally did your groin, you thought you were going to be back in 2 weeks? It was amazing the recovery that you had, and unfortunately you had that re-rupture. Is that part of it, or where does the main sense of frustration come for you?
I keep hearing the word frustration, but
it's not really, I don't want to put words in your mouth.
I'm not really frustrated about the situation. Like, it is what it is. I'm upset about it. I guess I was frustrated early that I've re-injured it, but that's not the overwhelming feeling that I'm feeling at the moment. The feeling is basically just like sadness and just missing out. And it's not like my life's consumed with it by it. It's just, it is what it is. And unfortunately, at the moment, I'm not doing what I want to be doing, and I'm probably not progressing as fast as what I'd like, and that's probably what it amplifies the feeling. As I said, like that obviously that chat up with Bucks was always going to get back to somebody with the cameras and people there, and ideally it doesn't, but I'm pretty comfortable talking about it because I know that I'm not the only bloke going through it in the AFL. There's, you know, 10 on each list, so it's something that as a professional athlete you have to deal with, and I actually enjoy being open with it. I've told, obviously, my teammates saw the conversation as well, and there's been some follow-up conversations about that, and it just sort of evokes help and support.
Yeah, and actually, you talk about the elite end and of so many people going through that, but people go through this sort of thing in recovery from different situations, not being able to be as engaged in the stuff, your day-to-day stuff.
Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
Having those discussions actually is really important.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. Yeah,
it's a good time to have a business where you can punch things for a while you're there. You're 12 round in Port Melbourne, the punching bags, you could just go there and just punch yourself silly.
Yeah, a fair bit of that, yes.
I'm not going to make any comment about anything that may or may not be before the integrity department.
What's the difference between betting irregularity and match fixing?
Well, what's the point of the question?
Well, if a player's been investigated for betting irregularity, does that also involve...
I haven't made any comment about anyone being investigated for anything.
No, that's why I said if a player is.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to deal in hypotheticals.
So you're not aware if there is an investigation as reported?
No, I didn't say that either. I said I'm not making any comment
I'm
about
asking the question.
What's the question now?
Are you aware of this investigation?
I said I'm not commenting on anything that may or may not be before the integrity department.
That's what he did say. He did say that. He wasn't listening, the journo, but good pressing against the chief yesterday, in fact, Gillon McLachlan facing the media on the crowd behaviour issues and the crowd relationship issues with the AFL yesterday. But it got sidelined a little bit because the news broke that Jaden Stevenson from the Magpies is being questioned by the AFL Integrity Unit for some betting irregularities. My understanding is, and Taylor Adams is with us in the Inner Sanctum. He's a teammate of Jaden Stevenson. Do you know much about this, Tay? Just to break it open quickly, do you know much about this?
Oh, like, clearly we're aware of what's happening. And there's, well, something's happened. We're just, I don't know any details about anything. I know basically as much as you guys do, and if I went out and said something, I'd be speculating and speaking in rumour and innuendo. So it's something that we hope was going to be resolved, you know, sooner rather than later. Yep. Because we've got a game to deal with this week, but unfortunately it hasn't been. We haven't come to a conclusion yet.
Are you fearful? Not, I don't know how far you look ahead or how much time you had to think about the possibilities of this scenario. Are you fearful that this could derail the Magpies season? Because he's an important player. If things go pear-shaped and he gets a suspension, which is very possible, that it might derail your season?
No. I don't really want to speculate about what is going to happen before it does. I think the best thing for us to do at the moment as a footy club is to wait for it to pan out, wait for it to play out, get all the facts, see what's handed down to Jaden, if anything, and then deal with it from there. And that's what I think is the best way to go about it.
Did you know about it? Did anyone know about it before yesterday at the club? Or from your team?
No, I didn't know about it until yesterday.
And what's the initial reaction when it comes out? Without speculating, but as a teammate and a mate of Jaden's, what goes through your mind?
Well, first and foremost, I sort of want to give the kid a big hug, make sure that he's okay, and it's, I don't know to what extent the impact this is going to have on him or on us. So I'm sort of hopeful that it's minimal. I think as a player and a teammate and a friend of Jaden, all I really care about at the moment is him and making sure that he's okay. And, yeah, he'll get a lot of support at the footy club, and he'll get a lot of support for as long as he needs it, depending on what happens with this situation.
The last question on it, are you surprised considering the situation with players and not being able to bet on games? Are you surprised that another Collingwood player is caught up in it? Does that surprise you?
Yeah, I guess so. I guess it does. That, well, again, I don't know what he's done, so it's hard for me to be surprised. But if it's, I think the rules are black and white for players. Yeah.
No pun intended.
Yeah. No pun intended.
Can I just broaden it out slightly? Because there is a lot of work that is done with AFL players in particular around education, around a lot of different areas, and gambling and this sort of thing is one of them. Can you take us through what that process is and how clear your understanding is of what's okay and what's not?
Yeah, it's really basic. It's basic. Basically, we get told every year about the rules and regulations around quite a number of things, and one of those is gambling and betting on our game in any form, and it's prohibited. So, pretty clear, for you,
there's no, as you say, there's no grey area.
It's very clear. Mm. Yeah.
So can I broaden it even further then? Last couple of weeks there's been a lot of conversation about gambling within the AFL.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen it firsthand that it actually is a problem? Would you through your experiences, say that it is an issue within the AFL community? The
gambling on AFL? Or
no, no, just get gambling full stop.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah, I think I think there's a lot that's done about making sure that there's no match fixing or anything like that, and no betting on necessarily AFL, but probably not enough about guys with gambling problems and, you know, spending too much money than they can afford to spend on betting. And it's I think it is a genuine issue within the AFL and within AFL players, and something that I think can be addressed for sure.
So who are the people that need to really be vocal about this element? Just the forget about Jaden and the footy betting, the gambling full stop in within the ranks. Who are the ones that you would like to see take charge of this conversation? Because it is seemingly having an effect on a lot of people within the industry.
Yeah, well, I think it's got to be a combined effort from the AFL, the AFLPA, and the players to make sure that we support people who are dealing with issues surrounding gambling. And I don't really know anyone personally who's actually going through a gambling issue, but you hear about it throughout the circles of the AFL. And I think it's something that's not just an AFL issue; it's a society issue. So it's very similar to the drug issue and maybe alcoholism and that sort of thing. So I think the AFL and the PA are doing a good job of trying to educate and help people, but there's always more we can do. And I guess it's something that's a little bit taboo in the AFL. Guys probably aren't all that open about how they're actually going with it. And it's something that the more open you can be, that I imagine the better off you'll be in controlling what can be a really, really dangerous habit.
The Bulldogs this week, it's an interesting matchup for you because
we're playing a game this week, are we?
Yeah, that's right. That's
we always get that, mate.
They played a really weird game against you earlier in the year. They really just tried to get the ball off you a lot of the time, and it was a real tactical battle. Do you expect the same thing again, or is it something that, did you learn a lot from that game to not get yourself sort of sucked into the way they want to play? What was your take out from that, and what can you learn going into this week?
I remember having the conversation after we played them, and it was basically that they sort of tried to hold the ball much more than they would usually, and tried to slow the game down quite a bit, which actually suits us as well. They're a really good stoppage team, and you know, their midfield's going as well as any. And when they're up and going, they're really hard to stop. So I think both sides like the fact that it can be a contested ball and stoppage game. And they probably tried to change that a little bit last time we played them. I think we're defending a lot better than we were back then. That was back in like round four or five. So yeah, it's interesting. Like our game style won't change too much, and we'll just focus on putting as much pressure on them as we can, and which we always do, and trying to turn into a game that suits us.
You've had your break. Have you had a sort of a bit of a mid-season review of things where you sort of assess where you're at? I know Nathan had said that he just wasn't entirely comfortable with how you're playing, even though you were winning most of your games over the season. What has he said to you, and what have you sort of assessed when we get to that mid sort of season report?
Yeah, there's some things we're doing really, really well, and there's some areas that we haven't quite done as well as we would have liked. I think the positive for us is our ladder position, and the positive for us is the upside with guys to come back in. We've got fresh legs. We'll get some energy back in the side over the next couple of weeks. You know, Jeremy Elliott sitting on the sidelines and looks like he's going to return at any given moment. So it's, and then there's guys in the VFL who are playing really good footy. There's definitely some things that we can work on and some things we can improve. We're controlling most of our games. We're just probably not finishing as well as we'd like to, and putting enormous scoreboard pressure on teams. We should have iced Melbourne in the first quarter on Queen's birthday. So there's an example of us leaving points out there. But yeah, I think overall our season today has been really positive. You don't necessarily need to be flying at this time of year, and exerting, you know, excessive amounts of energy. So I think we're doing it pretty well.
Doing it very well is what you're doing, and more to come in the back end of the season, hopefully for you and your boys, Taylor. I'm looking forward to seeing you back out there as well sooner rather than later. I hope it's all going well with your rehab. We'll look forward to seeing you soon, and we'll catch up. Thanks very much.
Thank you. Thanks, guys.
Mark Stevens is with us from Channel 7. Hello, Stevo.
Yeah, half Sherelle Whitey. That was a fascinating interview with Taylor Adams. He's a very open man, isn't he?
He's a very mature young man.
Very deep thinking guy. So
he's a ripper.
Be good to see him back soon. But it shows a lot about Bucks and the way he goes about it too, doesn't it?
Definitely.
Well, that's a very important point.
And the openness of Collingwood, the fact that Bucks were quite happy to have that chat down at the Holden Centre on Monday. And it was an extended chat in the goal square down the far end.
Were you there?
Yes, I was there, yeah.
Were you jumping out of the bin, behind the door?
No, not at all, half.
Just checking.
Just having a coffee, just checking down as we do. And it was just, I found it something... It was interesting to look at.
Did you know that it was happening at the time?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. So.
There's two things.
But it's good that Whitey asked the question. I like these, you know, it's hard hitting interview. I think Parkinson's got some issues.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. Firstly,
you're coming for
we are officially awarding a yellow card or brandishing a yellow card to Mark Stevens.
Mm.
He was told he had to bring in hot beverages this week.
It's true.
He didn't do it.
It's true.
Now, Cameron White did yesterday.
He did.
For the second consecutive week.
He did.
Joey Pignataro.
The pig.
At the back. He brought them in this morning, and which was a really pleasant surprise.
The pig did.
Mark, you didn't.
No, I didn't. I didn't even bring one for myself. I've got the Nescafe.
And then the second part of that
is... My friend at the door just made it for me.
I hope you weren't drinking coffee at the glasshouse on Monday.
Was it?
Is that where you were drinking your coffee?
It was. I was at the Glasshouse, at the Holden Centre. So I saw all that unfold. And it
seems to be a lot of journos drinking coffee at the Glasshouse recently.
Always something going on at Collingwood.
I don't know nothing about what's happening here. Sherelle, are we...
No,
is this thing on?
Yeah.
Are we live?
Are you comfortable with the yellow card?
Well, I don't know what coffee in the Glasshouse situation is.
No, I didn't bring myself. I didn't buy myself a coffee, so I didn't go to the shop.
Well, that was the knock on you last time you were here, was that you brought one for yourself and not us.
Yeah, so this is a Nescafe.
Instead of buying for everyone, you decided to buy for
next
no
week,
one.
Next week, I'll write a list before I leave, Whitey, of what everybody has. I know that yours will take a while to write down.
That's all right.
There'll be something feminine about it.
Now, tell us what you know about...
Fright.
The Jaden Stevenson situation.
Let's just change the subject, Dave.
Well, I just did, just for that reason. What do you know?
Well, it was an interesting day down at Collingwood. I believe the Integrity Office was in at the Holden Centre. I wasn't there having a coffee at that stage, but they were inside just delving into what unfolded. Now, my information is that Stevenson had a bet, not necessarily under his name. It's either on another account or via a syndicate on a teammate to have a certain amount of possessions.
Right. Okay. So the question that follows up from that, which we discussed off air this morning, is if it's through another person's account, why did he self-report?
That's the interesting scenario. Maybe he's just a totally honest person, which is fair enough.
I'm sure that's probably right. But
and also it may have been part of a syndicate, which in some way he's tangled up in.
Do we feel like there's been something that's happened that he's realised they will know about this? Like we were talking before about text messages or... Is anyone looking at that? No, this is just he's off his own bat. He's just come forward.
Yeah, well, they tend to find out, don't they, the Integrity people. Now, the other twist to this is that apparently the player who he did have the bet on to have a certain amount of stats was interviewed by the Integrity officers. So they're looking to see if there's any, which, heaven forbid, we don't think would ever happen in football.
Tentacles.
Well, they have to check that, don't they? Whether there's some sort of
well, I think in this
motion, right? The fact that they're talking together and just make sure you have 24, not 25, which we don't believe would ever happen in the AFL, but that's how deep the Integrity officers are going, that the player who the bet was involved with was also interviewed by the Integrity officers.
Right, well, that makes sense, I must admit.
Well, I think the thing about spot fixing is that in cricket, it's all about how many runs you make, and there's a line, under, over line. And that was the issue with a lot of international cricketers when they were getting themselves into trouble. It was to make under a certain amount of runs and they were getting out under a certain amount of runs. In the situation in AFL football, it's on
disposals under and over. And so I think that's going to be the... It's not a specific number, it's under and over a number. So that's what would be the alarming part of this for Jaden Stevenson, that he was involved in a game where he has suggested a bet take place on a player to have a certain amount of disposals, of which he was a teammate. So that's where he's going to get in trouble, similar to the situation with Nick Maxwell playing forward in a game unexpectedly, and the link was that there were players that were betting on that outcome, that he kicked the first goal, even though he didn't, but he... I think he had a shot at goal and missed. But anyway, that's beside the point.
Well, an opportunity missed.
That's different to other players that have put in games where they've put the result, overall result, in multis and things like that, which have resulted in fines or suspended sentences and that sort of thing. This is seen as a more significant situation, even though he's only $50.
You think it's
the ramifications of information also getting out.
You think it's worse to have a little spot bet that can be manipulated than, say, to pick Collingwood to win by 39 plus?
I think it is, yeah, because I think it's the potential of, or what is that, where else is that information getting to, potentially?
Well, Heath Shaw had a $10 bet in 2010 or 11. 11 it was. $10 bet. He was banned for 14 games. Mm. Six of those suspended, so he served 8. That's $10.
And that was using inside information. So we don't know what the specific is, but let's just take this situation out and say it was two other teams playing, and the player knows that they're going to play as a defensive forward as opposed to a midfielder. So you go on the under the disposals as opposed to over the disposals, knowing that he's not going to get much midfield time. That's taking clear inside information and using that to your advantage. So that's that. I'm trying to just explain what the possibilities are, rather than having $50 on Collingwood to win on Queen's birthday, which I'm playing. Well, it's like, well, what's the big deal in that? Mm. You want to win every game. That's an incentive to win. This is where there's a potential delineation or differentiation.
Obviously, integrity people check to see if the other player involved was either running away from the footy,
was in cahoots, unders,
or it was in cahoots, basically, which there's sort of no inference whatsoever that happened. But that's how deep they're looking into it at the Holden Centre.
Well, Gil wasn't talking about it yesterday, but he was talking about stadium patrols and fan engagement and fan behaviour and all that sort of stuff. How did he go yesterday, the Chief?
I thought he was all right. It was a bit of a showdown there. It was a big media throng, and there were a few journos going pretty hard.
Who are the ones that went the hardest?
It was Paul Dowsley from Channel 7 and TJ.
TJ
from Channel
9,
head to head. They both went hard. I think there might have even been two cameras there for TJ. So you know that the journo's going to go hard when you've got a camera on the journo
and a camera on your own microphone in press conferences.
Yeah, that's right. So it just adds a little bit of drama, doesn't it? And it's often about the journos as well.
Not really, but anyway.
Well, with a press conference like that, they were going pretty hard. But in the end, Gil played it pretty straight and pretty well, I thought.
Why did he wait till now to actually come out and speak about it?
Maybe a little bit. Maybe it was 24 hours too late. But I think the AFL are a little bit confused about where this has all come from. It's really grown legs in the last probably week. And they still say that hasn't been too many changes to the way they're going about things, apart from a couple of shirts that were printed that were crazy with...
That's not true, because a Richmond cheer squad member got suspended for 3 weeks, which has never happened before, for calling an umpire bald-headed flog. Then a patron gets evicted from the venue for calling the umpire green maggot. Then a patron gets evicted for calling the umpire a bald-headed flog. This has never happened before. Those words have been uttered before in footy crowds. I've heard them.
Yep.
I may have even said them.
Yeah, I think maggot... my wife said two weeks ago, don't call the umpire a maggot. And I thought, well, people have always called the umpire a maggot. Now I'm not sure whether I can call them a maggot anymore. So it is confusing. Have you called an umpire a maggot?
No.
What's wrong with calling him a white maggot?
Well, it's just not something I'd do.
Right, okay. But it's so common, Whitey. It has been so common. Half you would have done it,
but
all
just
through the 80s.
Just because something is common doesn't mean it's right, though.
And but it was a wake-up call for me.
But we understand that the umpire isn't in fact a maggot, so it's actually we understand that.
I know.
That's kind of a term of endearment.
Like it's a term of endearment.
In a way.
I'd like to know what way.
I would never call an umpire a
So the short story is things have changed. And the frustration from fans, it seems, for headquarters is that they haven't had communications with the venues, which are claiming responsibility, or Gillen is saying have responsibility over these recent changes in crackdowns on fan behaviour. So they, as the governing body of the game, the custodians of the game, should have been in better, more communication with the venues as to what the hell they're doing, and then articulating that to the fan base so they know exactly what's happening. That's the criticism that has been labelled across the AFL in the last week or so.
Well, it snowballed fairly quickly, though, Half, didn't it? And there's different partners, different stadiums. So they've now acted, and I think we're all relieved that...
Have they acted?
Well, they've chatted to the police, they've chatted to the stadia.
Yeah, but I think what Half says, and we talked about this yesterday...
And it'll be more subtle, Whitey. This week it won't happen.
But I think the key was that for weeks, the AFL have said there's been no crackdown, and... what they've been saying and what's been happening have been two completely different things.
Yes.
So a lot of the issue is around communication, and I think we would all feel that if we were sort of led through this as football fans to know what to expect, that most of the footy fans would actually feel comforted by the fact that the fans were being looked after, because there were a lot of fights that were breaking out that were getting a lot of attention over the past couple of months. And if that was the reason why there was an increase in security, then I think we'd all be comfortable with that. It's just that it's gone out of control, yet the AFL have said, oh, well, we haven't said anything. Well, if it's the AFL's game, they should be the ones that should be controlling the situation, and I don't think they have been.
Agreed.
Yep, but I think we're relieved that it'll be more subtle.
Let's see it first. Let's just see what happens first.
Yep, but I think the supporters just need to calm down, just get on with the football as well.
The media or the fans?
No, the fans. I think the AFL Fans Association probably just cool their jets.
I think the fans have every right to be up in arms.
Yeah, they have every right to be up in arms, but let's just give it a chance this week. Let's just not get too negative about our experiences at the footy.
Well, up until yesterday, there'd been no feedback from headquarters about what they thought about the situation and what they were going to do about it. So I think up until yesterday, the fans are quite rightly entitled to be blowing off some steam about the way they've been portrayed and treated.
But I don't like the term boycott. I love Joffa, but it's crazy that Joffa...
Well, Joffa boycott of the week when the Magpies had the bye, which is interesting.
And the gaffer tape. I mean, you're going to bring your own gaffer tape to the footy, Whitey, this week?
Well, make a statement. At least you didn't stick his...
I won't be going.
Well, that's the issue too. Like, you're commenting on crowd behaviour and you're never in the crowd, are you out, and don't go to the footy.
Back to McClure, who makes a gap. And it's the fourth goal for Sam Kerr. An absolute goalkeeping howler has played in Australia's favour. Sam Kerr was onto it very quickly.
It doesn't matter how you get them, as long as you get them. And you might not think that four is much more than three, but for the Australians today, this morning in their game against Jamaica in the Women's World Cup, it was a very, very important fourth goal for Sam Kerr. 4-1 was the result over Jamaica, and got us through to second in Group C, which is very, very important. One man who knows more about that than I do is Craig Foster, SBS football analyst, who joins us on The Breakfast Club. Good morning, Craig.
Yeah, good morning, guys. Yeah, that last goal, gee. That was absolutely critical. So it's nice, you know, the team are through in second position or playing Norway, so they're well positioned to go further in the tournament.
Now, we know that it was a very important one. We would have gone through anyway as a third, one of the best third teams, but what would that have meant in terms of who we would have played had we ended up in Brazil's spot in the Group C?
Well, it meant, to my understanding, that we would have likely played France, who, of course, are the home nation, who are one of the strongest in the world. One of the top two seeds, and it would have been incredibly difficult. We still got a bit of improvement to make. You know, there were still some issues this morning against Jamaica, so I think it's positive. Whilst the players will say, oh, well, you've got to beat all the top teams to win it, that's true, but you'd rather beat them at the last hurdle than now. So that goal is just critically important. To play Norway is a team that Australia will feel really confident against. It's going to be a tough match, but nowhere near as tough as what it could have been.
Well, talk to us about Sam Kerr. Four goals in that game. Yeah. She was absolutely unbelievable. Found herself in some great space, and you know, a couple of maybe lucky ones came her way. Is that true? I don't know. But she was she is incredible.
No, she's amazing. Look, she scored two headers, and both of them were really quite amazing headers. It's a skill that not a lot of players are really brilliant at. That's arguably a skill that's going out of the game a little bit. But Sam Kerr, her athletic ability is one thing. You know, she's got a leap that's kind of like Timmy Cahill-esque, right?
Yeah.
But then when she's there, she's so very good. So she took her chances really well. She had a couple of other ones, which you know, with her quality, she might have even got more out of the game. But the nice thing about it is she hadn't scored in a World Cup. And I think it was the first game against Italy, I think, that she'd scored her first goal ever, and we said, okay, that's good. That's now kind of off her back. This morning has done what we all hoped she'd do. Is it has announced her as one of the big players of the tournament. That's a hat trick plus one, of course, but that puts her now into the global international spotlight as one of the great players in the world. And now all of that's behind her and she can just get her job done and hopefully score against Norway.
Yeah, when you spoke about some of the chances that she had across that game, Jamaica had some good chances too. Mm. They actually did some fairly intense attacking, particularly in that second half. What was it about the Australians' defence that allowed that to happen? Is that a concern?
It is, yes. In that second half, they got in behind us quite a few times. Firstly, just kind of diagonal balls cross behind our line. We weren't defending particularly well, but there was a couple of instances, one of which they scored from, where it's just through balls straight through the middle. Our defence has to drop at those moments, but we dropped with our spacing incorrect. We didn't read the situation well, and it's something they really should be capable of doing. I think in that centre of defence, you know, we've had a really key player, and that's Claire Polkinghorne, who's you know, being one of the co-captains, is a real leader in that group, who's been injured the last two games. I'd imagine now that we're getting against more difficult teams in round of 16, for Ante Milicic, the coach, he'd be hoping, as are we, that she can come back in there. You know, you need those two central defensive positions, really experienced players, knowledgeable, understand how to deal with everything. Beth Catley's done a brilliant job, but if we can get her back out into the attack on the left hand side as fullback and get our two central defenders back in, I think it'd be a big step forward.
So, Craig, we've got a new coach, obviously, for this World Cup. With what you've seen from the team and from the coach, mm-hmm. are you liking what you've seen? Because it's obviously such a stunning change to make before the World Cup.
Mm.
What are you liking and what are you concerned about?
Look, I think that he's got the job done to a reasonable degree so far. You know, it was a difficult... obviously he came in without a huge amount of time. I think Ante tried to change some defensive principles possibly or likely a little bit too quickly, and it wasn't working well against Netherlands and then Italy. He did change it, so he demonstrated you know, his ability to make those decisions on the run under pressure. So I think he's done well there. He's still got quite a lot of work to do. You know, when it comes, we've got with the ball and without. And without the ball, we've clearly got some defensive problems, and Ante talked about those immediately post-match. But also with the ball, you know, we're very reliant on our crosses, and whilst that worked against Jamaica this morning, that's going to be much more difficult against a better organised teams who defend well in the air. So we've still got work to do. I think Ante has work to do, but so far he's done the job in the respect that he got them out of the group.
Mm.
This group was a great opportunity to finish first. You know, Australia was highest ranked in the group for the first time. That game against Italy really killed us.
Since then,
he's picked it up, and he's got them out. We're in a strong position. Norway is a good opponent for us, I think. So far, so good.
What's the general feeling coming out of the group after that win? Because we obviously all heard Sam's feelings after the game, after their win against Brazil, suck on that one, after she felt like there was some heavy criticism, maybe about different things coming the team's way. What's your sense about how she has felt about that after she made that comment, the team, and where are they at kind of mentally from that space at the moment?
Look, that's probably a question for Sam and the team. You know, I think I'm not quite sure what she was talking about. She came out, you know, she talked about the haters as well, and she sowed some social media homophobic comments, and I was delighted that she exposed those to the public. I think that's an important issue needs to be spoken about, and the Matildas have been wonderful in that space. So I think this team is a really important standard bearer for Australian sport, and in fact for teams around the world, in terms of you know, that issue of non-discriminatory nature and being comfortable in themselves and their own sexuality and so on. So that was great. when it comes to criticism, I'm not quite sure where she was talking about things on social media. You know, because the coach has been changed, there's been a lot of emotion and issues around. Perhaps she was talking about that. When it comes to the criticism, if you like, or the critique, is probably a better word, of the team, I think it's normal. In fact, it's necessary. It's a good discussion. And the team, I think, has to realise that the expectations have risen. And we want Australia to be in mourning. We want Australia to be feeling passionate about the team and about the game. And we want them to feel very strongly about issues affecting the team. So I think, look, they've clearly come together. The Brazil game was brilliant for them. They've put on a performance this morning that has got them through, is great. But they'll know that there's a lot to work on and they'll need to be better in the next group. I'm sure that's all they're focused on.
I couldn't agree more, Craig. Well said, I reckon. That was the best of The Breakfast Club. If you want to hear the full interviews again, go straight to the website, rsn.net.au.